Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that shape, challenge, and sometimes disrupt our daily lives. At 14, Olivia Zhang founded Cancer Kids First, now the world's largest youth-led nonprofit supporting children with cancer. After losing her grandfather and her elementary school teacher to cancer, Olivia didn't just grieve, turning her personal loss into global impact. In her new book, Youth, The Young Person's Guide to Starting a Nonprofit, Olivia breaks down the entire process: legal filings, branding, fundraising, leadership, in Gen Z language, complete with emojis, worksheets, and step-by-step tools. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me via the Zoom platform, I welcome Olivia Zhang from Boston at this time. So glad to have you.
Hi, so happy to be here.
Yes. Olivia, you were 14. What was exactly the moment that you decided, I'm going to start something, I'm going to do this?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it was almost a buildup, I guess, of my experiences, because like you mentioned, I lost two loved ones to cancer. And, you know, my parents, they immigrated from China to the United States at the age of 30. And like a lot of immigrant families, they came from, you know, came to this unknown country with no money and no support system. And so they spent long hours in work every day. And I got really close to my grandfather and elementary school teacher for that reason. And I started out kind of just fundraising and volunteering with different cancer hospitals and also to support their cancer treatment when they were diagnosed in my late elementary school years. And eventually when they passed, 2 months apart from each other, I kind of entered this really, really dark state, and I shut out all my loved ones. I didn't really know how to navigate those mental health difficulties. And I think it started with just doing a small act every day to kind of get myself out of bed every morning, because I told myself that I wanted to honor them in some way. So it was just, I guess, like a small act of kindness. And then eventually that I was kind of, I guess, I didn't like how I couldn't see the impact that I was making through my donations because I had no say over where the money was going. And so that's kind of what prompted me to sit down and do research on what other projects I could start on my own so I could really utilize the knowledge and skill set that I had to make a difference in the cancer community. And so that's kind of how it led to coming up with the idea to start a nonprofit and then eventually building out Cancer Kids First.
But usually most teens in the face of illness and death feel powerless, okay? I mean, what made you feel so capable? What was it? Just can you share with us what you experienced at first? Meaning, how did you feel so capable to do this? And then how did the adults in your life respond to it? Did they take you seriously at all?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely not. I think age was, you know, the biggest barrier. And I actually, a lot of people don't know this, but after the first like 6 months, maybe, of running the organization, we had gotten over 70 plus, you know, rejections from hospitals, from companies, when we asked for partnerships. And I even took a break for a few months from working on it because I was so discouraged, especially I was just turned off by, you know, the response that adults gave. And I think adults are very quick to assume that, you know, oh, this is another, I guess, high school student who just wants to do like a one-time fundraiser and cause, and it's not really going to amount to anything. I mean, I didn't even tell my parents for the first few months too. And I kept it a secret from them because it just seemed to me that nobody believed in this mission and vision that I had. And I was very meek at this time as well. You know, I think this is something that isn't always talked about, but Asian American, especially Asian American women, we're not taught to lead or speak out. And we're kind of expected to keep our heads down and just work hard, especially focus on academics. And so I also was never taught on how to pitch myself and how to advocate, you know, for the things that I care about. So that first year was very much like me and my founding team, like pushing each other, being like, you talk to the stranger. And then like, after you talk to the stranger, then I'll take you out for ice cream. Like, it was a very much like we had to push each other, you know, to break that fear barrier almost of learning to advocate for this nonprofit that we wanted to do. And then through trial and error, also experimenting with like, how do we create an effective pitch deck? How do we display our story through like a 1 minute kind of like elevator pitch on a call with someone? And learning all these things together, I think, was so much fun and also really gave us the building blocks to eventually get to where we are today.
Well, we want to get back to some of those points that you mentioned, but did you have any fears? What fears did you have?
I think the biggest one was definitely that, you know, nobody would kind of believe in what we were doing, and everything that I had, I guess, like dreamt of and almost like promised to my grandfather and teacher was going to be all for nothing. I think that was like the biggest fear, just, you know, the fear of failure. And I think that this was something that I journaled a lot about in terms of, I think it was helpful that I had started this to honor two loved ones. And so at the end of the day, it was not about like the number of people that we had helped, but more so about the actual like in-depth impact that we were able to make. And I found a lot of great mentors and female role models who would sit me down. And anytime I guess like navigated some sort of difficulty, whether it was like I was the only girl in like a room full of 15 like adult men who had children older than I was, you know, and they like didn't give me a chance to speak or hear my ideas or opinions. I think finding solace in like those mentors and those circles that I had, that gave me the further confidence to kind of, I guess, like push past those fears.
Well, we certainly applaud you. You've done an excellent job. Do you have any suggestions on how teens approach decisions on what issue to focus on? I mean, for example, you went from an idea to a first step. How did that happen? Do you have any suggestions in advising teens who may be where you are, who may be very interested in starting a nonprofit?
For sure. I think the most important thing I always say is to do community mapping, which is, you know, I think starting local is always great. Thinking about it doesn't necessarily need to be like an everyday problem, but some sort of issue or community group that you want to help that is very local to like you, your family, your school, looking at the local news, even social media. I think when you, like, I always describe it like, and this is something I think a lot of startup founders even relate to, but every time I thought about childhood cancer, every time I worked on Cancer Kids First, I felt this insatiable like fire almost, you know, and that is what pushes you through the rejections, the long nights, the burnout. And without that close personal tie, I don't think I could have lasted this long. And I don't think I could have, you know, built this organization into what it is today. So I always recommend starting local, personal. And after that, assessing organizations like in your area that already serve the same group or address the same cause. I think that's so important to make sure that you're not overlapping or, you know, competing necessarily with other organizations. So that was like, I did a lot of research on other childhood cancer organizations in my state and also, you know, throughout the country. And after that, the last step I would say is really just talking to your target community. I think it's so important in the service world to ensure that you're not just coming in with this like almost savior mindset. You know, it's you take the time to understand the people that you're trying to help and what they really need, and you cater your services and your programs and your ideas to what their stories and their, you know, realistic needs are.
What mistakes would you warn young folks, young founders, about making at this stage in the game?
Ooh, I think the first one is definitely not to get caught up, I guess, in, you know, what your peers are doing. And I think this is obviously easier said than done. I know I myself did this often, but I think social comparison is something that is really pervasive, especially in our generation, because social media makes it so that you can check, you know, the status of your friends like 24/7. And I think that's harmful in the sense that I remember, like, I cared so much about service and leadership and this kind of work, but I guess like the peers around me weren't necessarily doing something like this. This was a little bit more, I guess, like out of the box. And I would be like, almost like guilt tripping myself, being like, oh, I shouldn't be working on this. I should focus on my academics more, or, you know, play a sport or dedicate my time to something that I guess like other people are doing. And I think I could have gotten a lot further if I, you know, didn't spend that much mental, physical energy wishing that I was, you know, good at something else or like interested in something else, and kind of just realize like, this is what I am passionate about and this is what I'm going to put 110% of my effort into. So I think that's definitely the first thing. And then the second thing is, I think it's very easy when you're, it doesn't even have to be a nonprofit, but just building anything at this age, to immediately want to hire, you know, your friends, or like bring your friends on to the founding. And I think this was a mistake that I made, just because, you know, I thought it was fun to hang out with my friends after school and call it a club meeting. I guess think as much about the skill sets, the long-term effects that integrating like a work relationship with a friendship like that would have, because that really strains the friendship and it affects the rest of your leadership team as well. So I wish I kind of branched out in terms of sourcing talent, because now, you know, our team of 35 is from all across the U.S.
Olivia, can you hold your thoughts for a second? We're at that time where I said we're going to need to take a break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I'm talking with Olivia Zhang, and she's talking about establishing a nonprofit. We're going to take a break, but we'll get right back at you. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I am talking with Olivia Zhang, author of Youth, The Young Person's Guide to Starting a Nonprofit. And she's also the founder of Cancer Kids First. This is now the world's largest youth-led nonprofit supporting children with cancer. Olivia, I had to interrupt you before we went on break, and you had some other thoughts you wanted to share.
Yeah, I was kind of just talking about how, you know, our current leadership team now is a team of 35 from all across the U.S. and Canada, and having these diverse opinions, being able to, you know, if we're having some kind of communication platform issue, it's like all these different people, because they went to different schools, are part of different clubs, they have so many more suggestions, and it's helped our organization innovate, which I think has driven a lot of our growth and our success. So I'm definitely so thankful that, you know, now our team is kind of brings in these like diverse opinions and range of ideas, but that was definitely not something that I originally, I guess, thought about.
Do you feel like teens need to have an adult, or at least consider having adults on their board when you set up a nonprofit like this?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, you definitely, it is a requirement to officially establish 501c3 status, but also just in general, I think it's always great to have adult mentors who sometimes, you know, we get so caught up, we as in, you know, my leadership team and I, we get so caught up in, oh, like should the funding that we just got go towards this program or this program? And we can let our personal, you know, judgment or perspectives like cloud that. And so being able to like go to like a third party source who has had a lot more, you know, professional experience and can kind of guide us in the right direction, I think that has always been so helpful. So having this like adult board, like they give us a lot of ideas and strategies that we as young people can't figure out and realize. And then in turn, we also have taught them a lot. And so I think it's honestly a great give and take.
Explain to the listening audience exactly what is a nonprofit.
Yeah, so a nonprofit is essentially, there's, you know, many different categories that can go into it, but it's a business entity, but it's created for public or social benefit. So the reason why nonprofits don't have to pay taxes and they get tax exempt status is because their services and their mission and their employees are all dedicated to serving a social, charitable, or educational cause.
Okay. What are the first, and you've kind of shared this, but what are the first official steps you have to take to register? And what I'm trying to find out is what steps you had to take to register and just how long, for those who are listening, they get a feel for just how long this process is. How does this legal process evolve and how long is it?
Yeah, so something I actually didn't realize is the government forms that you have to file do cost quite a bit of money.
Oh,
So
they have
we
financial
had
responsibilities too. I was going to ask you that, okay?
the first thing there's, I mean, you have to file within your state's Secretary of State. So every state has a little bit of different guidelines, but in general, you need to file articles of incorporation. And that's almost like what I think of it like a nonprofit constitution kind of. It permanently, you know, establishes your organization. And then you include bylaws, which talk about internal rules for how your nonprofit's going to operate and meeting procedures and officer rules. And then you appoint a board of directors. So that's where, you know, having adults come in is very helpful. And then after you establish within your state, the next step is to obtain a federal tax ID called a EIN. So I think of it like a social security number, but for your nonprofit. And then lastly, you have a form called the Form 1023. And this is essentially related to tax fees, and kind of like recording and tracking your nonprofit's financial status. So I remember in total, I think we had spent around $400. And it generally takes, I would say, minimum 6 months to hear back, you know, from all these steps. But it depends on, I guess, like the IRS busy season and how many people are, you know, filing to start different things. But usually, I would say from our experience, we had waited around 4 to 6 months.
Now, what does branding involve? And I'm thinking, you know, the naming, logo, you know, ID, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think branding, this is something that I have had a lot of fun with. I think that some, even nonprofits, you can think of it like a startup in the sense of branding, because definitely coming up with some sort of name logo that when people look at it, they can immediately remember what your organization does and who it supports. I think that's first and foremost. And then going from there, thinking about, you know, how your social media, how your website are going to tie in the logo and the colors and your mission statement. You want to kind of keep it a one-liner that's very to the point and concise in terms of communicating, you know, what your organization's about. And I think all those elements matter a lot more than I had originally thought, because that is from the face value, like what volunteers are going to see, what partners are going to see, what potential donors are going to see. And it's also what distinguishes you, obviously, from other, you know, organizations. And so when you're in a field such as the childhood cancer one, where there's so many different organizations, it's really critical in terms of like picking the shape of your logo, the shades of the color that you're using. You want it to like communicate effectively to your target audience.
Okay. All right. How did you come up with Cancer Kids First?
I think it's almost like a play on words because the goal was, you know, my grandfather, he was also a teacher, and his philosophy, my elementary school teacher's philosophy was both to put their students first. And so I wanted to create this organization that would put kids with cancer first. So I kind of just rearranged the words so it would be Cancer Kids First. Okay. But actually, our you know, acronym is CKF, and my board told me, I did not listen to them evidently, but it sounds like KFC, like people are gonna mix up KFC with CKF.
You mentioned earlier about, you know, selecting folks to be mentors and be on your board, but how do, will you talk to teens who may really be interested about recruiting other teens? Who do you look for? What do you look for as far as having board members and folks on the team?
Yeah, for sure. So I think some nonprofits like do it differently, and it's definitely how you want to kind of section off your work almost, because I would say that you kind of need to sit down and you need to think about, okay, what are the services that we're going to provide, and how can our volunteers kind of carry out those services? And then also administratively, like, do we want people to help out with website design, with social media? Do we want volunteers helping out with like research and writing reports or anything like that? So once you separate everything, your nonprofit out into, I guess, like the work, quote unquote, that needs to be done, then you can figure out, you know, the quality of traits that you want in your volunteers. So our service programs, like one of them is creating arts and crafts for kids with cancer. So naturally a trait that we want is people who are creative and artistic. And for that reason, the applications that we put out will sometimes ask for like a sample art piece or talk to us about like your experience with art, something like that. And so I think creating applications that you share on social media, on LinkedIn, on different like volunteer job posting board sites, those allow you to, again, like reach that diverse kind of audience that I was talking about before. That is very important. So thinking about those traits is great. In terms of team members and board of directors, I think that is a lot harder. I think for board of directors, you should definitely find professionals in your area, your industry almost. So for us, since we're cancer, we look for, you know, a lot of advice from people who are involved in social impact, in youth leadership, in healthcare. So finding experts in these fields ensure that obviously, like anytime you need advice on something or face a problem, you're literally going to, you know, the expert in that field. And I also think that it's very difficult to assess, I guess, somebody's, you know, work fit without seeing them actually do work. So we have like a very, very rigorous like application process in terms of joining our leadership team. And so we'll do like a written application, we'll do interviews, and also what I call like a trial week where they get an assignment and we kind of see how they integrate into our team culture, how they communicate when, you know, working on the trial event, things like that. But definitely just finding people who are able to learn and open to feedback. That's so important. And also they believe wholeheartedly in your cause and will dedicate and, you know, prioritize it as an extracurricular. I think those are two of the, some of the most important traits that you need to look for.
Once you have this team, Olivia, how do you lead people your own age? And I'm thinking, have you ever had conflict within your team? How did you handle that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, this is one of the biggest challenges. Like, this is not something that, you know, teachers can teach you, you know, or that you can learn in school. And this was definitely, I think, where I struggled the most, but where I also grew the most just throughout these past 6 years with leading Cancer Kids First, because naturally when you work with people who are almost your same age, it's number one, like sometimes hard to command respect. And how do you balance like being professional versus being empathetic and understanding like where they're coming from? So I think the first thing I had to realize was like setting a boundary almost with my team in terms of I want them to like text me about them going on their first date and like get super excited about that. But if it comes to exam season and they aren't meeting deadlines, they need to understand that, you know, they have an obligation and expectations. And I have to be able to communicate that both through email, text, and also, you know, over the phone in person. And I think finding that balance was very, very difficult at first. And honestly, it got better through like trial and error and figuring out like when I should be more compassionate versus kind of almost have like a steel leadership mindset. And I think also navigating like leading a team who's your age, it's also difficult because if you're closer to some people on the team, like other people might see that as favoritism. Firing someone is also so hard. I remember the first time I like hid in a closet when I was on the phone firing a girl, like under a bunch of blankets, even though she could not even see me. It was a phone call, but my voice was shaking, like I was just so scared. And I had never like I felt responsible for her life almost, even though it was obviously not that dramatic. And so it was definitely like almost like exposure therapy. Like I just had to do it more times in order to be comfortable with it. But I learned a lot from my mentors in terms of like how many strikes, you know, does a person get maybe before you need to let them go, and like how I have to listen to my gut if I can tell that somebody is not prioritizing work or something like that. I think when you have also a team of high school students, like naturally they are all thinking about exams, about other extracurriculars, about college applications, and they're all stressed. And keeping that in mind and like reminding myself like, okay, when I was in high school, like what was I thinking about and stressing about? And being able to like be in their shoes, I think that's also helped me kind of relate to them and also, I guess, you know, make difficult decisions when need be.
Well, what about burnout? How do you prevent it? How do you address
Yeah,
it?
I think burnout in terms of preventing it can be difficult. It's definitely a matter of what I do is I separate my life into quadrants. I have four quadrants, so personal, academic, career, and relationships. And I'll kind of configure within, I guess, like the since you know I'm in college, so I operate on a semester system. So every semester I'll be like, okay, I'm prioritizing my academics, or this year for as a junior, I'm prioritizing my career. And so I think focusing on, I guess, different quadrants of my life like that, it allows me to almost like save mental energy and space in terms of honing in on like one specific area that I really want to grow or do well in. And also, I encourage every young person to like write out their non-negotiables, even adults too. Like, my non-negotiables are every morning I have to work out, and I want to like be like have my mornings to myself, like my journal time, my breakfast time. Like I need like 2 hours just to myself to kind of start the day. And that's something that's non-negotiable. So my class schedule, I'll orient around that. Like meetings, I'll never put before 9 a.m. so that I can, you know, do my workout without stressing. And then I also a non-negotiable is like my friends matter more than anything to me. And so all my meals will be with my friends or certain days like Friday, Saturday, I'll reserve a lot of the times for social events and engagements. And that allows me to kind of like find these like practices and things that I do for myself, you know, and again, like allows me to balance out, I guess, like the work and the stress. It's another non-negotiable I have is like reading 30 minutes before bed every night. So little things like that, I think that helps me like make sure that the stress doesn't build up in a sense. And if it does, I know that certain periods of your life will obviously be more, you know, stressful than others. I think it's giving yourself a day to just rot and literally like don't look at your calendar, don't look at your emails, Put your phone, do not disturb. Like, feel free to see your friends, like, order comfort food, watch a TV show. And I sometimes just that one day reset, I think, will really help me a lot, get back into it. So I think that those are kind of the strategies that I use. But definitely anytime you feel yourself like getting sick or feeling an inkling of like kind of tiredness, I would definitely say to take a step back. And burnout is often caused by, you know, doing things that you don't enjoy and feel like you have to force yourself to do. So I also sometimes will make a list of all the commitments that I have in my life and anything that I find myself, I guess, dreading, or I'll like write out like what I like about each commitment versus don't like. I'll just use that as a time to cut things out of my life to also help with burnout.
Well, in talking to what I hear you saying, because I, another question I was going to ask you is, how do you balance school and friendship and nonprofit leadership? And I think you've answered it because it sounds like you, first of all, use some time management skills and you organize according to various departments. And then you compartmentalize what you have to do. And by the time you do all that, and it runs the, you got it going well, and that's how you handle it. Is that a good way of describing it? Just a real quick way of describing, because that's what I hear you saying.
Yeah, no,
Okay,
exactly.
because I, I want those who are listening to be able to, think about these things. That's why I'm asking you all this. What are the problems? What are the hiccups you've seen? Because they're going to encounter them, and like you were saying, one of the big problems was having to lead other people of your own age. We're going to take a break, and I appreciate you sharing all of this. We're going to take a brief break. At this point, you're tuned in to 411 Team.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holifield, and I am talking with a dynamic young woman, Olivia Zhang, author of Youth, The Young Person's Guide to Starting a Nonprofit, and she's the founder of Cancer Kids First. It is now the world's largest youth-led nonprofit supporting children with cancer. Olivia, we really appreciate you for taking the time again to just share this information. I think it's invaluable for those who may be walking in your footsteps. Can you talk about your first fundraiser? I mean, how do you ask for money? I mean, I think that that's one of the issues lots of nonprofits experience.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely so hard, especially I think the age barrier really does not help because it's hard to get people to take you seriously. Our first fundraiser was very, very grassroots. It was a bake sale outside of Kumon in our like a local academic center, and we had stayed up baking. I don't remember. I think it was like 70 cupcakes, and we were standing in front of the table in like November. It was so cold out, and my team and I, it was me and two others, and we would literally just be like, "Oh, like please, please, like the next person that comes, you do it, you do it." Like I already did the other one. Like we were forcing each other, you know, to essentially like ask for money and pitch this organization to help fundraise, which I just remember being so scared as a 14-year-old having to stand there and do that. And over time, like over those, I think 3 hours, we kind of solidified a strategy, which was you start off, you know, asking the person how their day is, and then you want to connect to your audience. So we were talking to a lot of parents. So we would talk a lot about how, obviously, you know, could you imagine if your child was diagnosed with cancer, or do you know anybody who has been diagnosed with cancer because it's such a prevalent cause? And I think using that draw in where it ties directly to them, and then doing like a one-liner pitch about what our organization does and how all profits were going to be donated to our cause, that's kind of how what we realized, you know, the strategy that worked. And that eventually translated into us figuring out in emails. How do we structure a clear and concise email where it illustrates the stats that we already have built, so that brings in credibility? How do we kind of in like a easy two paragraphs like indicate the partnership idea that we had and also how it would ultimately benefit the company or the person that we're asking money from? Because that obviously they want to see, you know, how it's going to benefit them. I think learning that, like how to cold pitch, was crucial to our beginning success. And we started building like pitch decks and in-person presentation scripts where it allowed us to also pitch in person. So it kind of like built off from that, I guess, like mini like cupcake moment to these more efficient kind of long-term strategies.
What mistakes would you advise teens when it comes to fundraising? If there's even just one fundraising mistake that you think teens could avoid, what would it be?
I think, I guess like something that we did a lot was try to compete for, I guess, grant and money that I think very established organizations, like adult organizations, don't even get. So something that I wish I knew earlier on was like using our youth-led kind of team and energy to our advantage. For instance, it doesn't apply to just fundraising, but let's say like in fundraising, there are so many awards that give out grant money specifically for young people. And it's created by organizations, for instance, like the Gloria Barron Prize, the Diana Award, like all these kind of companies, organizations are literally founded on the premise of elevating the next generation of social change makers. And they care about the fact that you're a young innovator. And so you want to really elevate that part of your story in kind of like sharing why and like pitching why the money should go to you. So I think I wish earlier on that we had directed more of our energy and like research into pitching for money from these type of kind of companies and organizations and like adults who literally said that it was a value of theirs to invest in the next generation. And now with like this new wave of technology and the things, different things that are going on in our world, I think even more companies and adults are now committing money, resources, platform opportunities, et cetera, to young people, which I think is amazing. And so being able to like turn, like put a spin on your age, you know, and talk about how it's not a barrier, but actually something that can be utilized and be an advantage. I think that is super important.
When did you realize that Cancer Kids First was bigger than you had imagined? I mean, it's really grown by leaps and bounds, but when did it all settle with you?
Yeah, I remember this moment pretty clearly. Because I think what really took us from national to international was capitalizing on the pandemic and TikTok. And it was definitely, I think this was early 2021 or late 2020, early 2021. And I remember I mean, I was super intrigued by this whole growth of TikTok, but I watched from a very objective point of view in terms of understanding why are certain videos going viral. I also thought about, you know, we're in this place during the pandemic, like in society, where so many people are scared and what they're looking for is hope, you know, and they're at home, they don't have much to do. And so how can like Cancer Kids First introduce an opportunity like volunteering virtually, for instance, to these individuals in a way that's gonna kind of convince them to turn their inaction into something that'll make them feel really good about themselves and at the same time make a difference in the world. And by kind of creating videos exactly on that, like highlighting the virtual volunteer opportunities that we had and the ways that everybody, any age from any place around the world could get involved. We posted like a couple videos, and then like the next morning we woke up and they like went viral with like over 4 million views that we got in a week. And it was crazy because I remember opening my inbox and it was like thousands and thousands of emails. Or DMs. Like it was like increase of like hundreds of followers. It was absolutely crazy. And so that was definitely the pivotal moment where I was like, oh my God, like this could turn into a global movement.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, I mean, if you had one thing that you wished adults understood better about teens today, because some of the issues that you've had have been with adults. They didn't take you seriously. You didn't get the respect you needed. But if you had one thing you wish adults would understand about today's teenagers, what would it be?
I think I would really like them to see and then also invest in our potential. I think that it's clear now that with everything going on in the world, especially from that kind of community social impact lens, it's up to, you know, our generation to change things. Mm-hmm. And we clearly are getting things done. And so I would really like adults to kind of, I mean, you know, they, assuming they have like children, like look to your nephews, your, like any young person in your life. And I think really acknowledge and appreciate the innovative ideas that they have, like how we're so readily connected to technology that can be turned into a really positive things. Mm-hmm. For instance, mass mobilizing through social media, like we did, you know, and then creating like programs, opportunities, internships, even like for young people to be exposed to different career pathways and ideas. And I think that that is just going to be so important in like building that next pipeline for the greatest leaders and change makers in a very, very positive way.
On the flip side there, what would you say to another young person who has an idea, you know, they're passionate about their idea, they want to take that first step, but they're afraid to start?
I wish I had like a microphone and I could say this to everybody. I definitely would encourage you to not let your fear, you know, serve as an obstacle. I think that actually fear is a great sign that obviously you're facing something that maybe you're uncomfortable with, but that's, I think, even more reason to do it, because that means that there's so much potential for you to learn and grow, you know, in that respective mm-hmm. field. Mm-hmm. And so you can take it from my story and my example. You know, I didn't necessarily kind of grow up with the best circumstances, but I was able to turn something negative into something positive mm-hmm. and at the same time learn more about myself as a person, gain all these incredible skill sets, opportunities, like new friendships and mentors and network. And I wholeheartedly credit Cancer Kids First for that. Mm. So for any young person who has any sort of idea that they want to take action on, I would say that you are never, you know, too young to start, and really, really kind of invest in yourself and believe in yourself and reach out to people that you admire, like cold emailing is going to become your best friend, because those are the people who are going to, I think, help give you those resources and uplift you to get started.
Tell us about your book, for those who are listening, where they can purchase it, and what does youth, they can't see it, but capital YOU, lowercase TH, what does that ultimately stand for?
Yeah, so youth, it's kind of, my dad will actually really appreciate this because he came up with the name of the book.
Okay.
It's supposed to be like a, almost like a play on words, like the U is in all caps because hopefully whoever walks by the book it's, you know, they're convinced, like, okay, like I can take action. It's kind of placing the emphasis on the reader, the person, to do something to make a difference in the world. And the book is just the guidebook that I honestly wish I had when I was 14 and starting this organization. You know, back in the olden days, ChatGPT wasn't there yet, so I couldn't ask, like, oh, how do you start an organization from like the youth perspective? Like all these things that we talked about today, how do you lead a team, you know, who's your own age? How do you navigate burnout and time management, especially juggling school and being a full-time student with your other family, extracurricular responsibilities? All these things are kind of mapped out in youth, like through direct templates and checklists. And these lessons, I think, are everything that I learned, and also what 13 plus other really successful youth nonprofit founders also wish that they knew at this age. And so it's designed to be this like blueprint to really develop any young person's like leadership mindset and skill sets to help them create their own passion project.
When you look back, where, you know, when you started back at 14 to where you are now, what part of the journey has changed you the most? What part of the journey has changed you? What have you learned about self? What impact has it had on you, this whole project?
Yeah, I think so. I like look back sometimes at, you know, my old camera roll, and I'll like look back to my freshman year self, and I am honestly just so proud of the woman that I am today. And I think that I've been pushed to do a lot of different things because of my organization. And the biggest change I definitely see is like I'm just more confident in myself. I know my values. I understand my intrinsic why. And it's because, you know, this organization, like for instance, public speaking, I was always so scared. I could never do it. And I hated talking to strangers, hated talking to adults. But you very naturally like can't be afraid of doing that when you're building this organization and trying to scale something that you care about. So that forced me out of my comfort zone all the time in terms of like taking these different speaking opportunities to share my work, pitching to investors and partners, introducing myself at like co different conferences and networking events. So I think learned a lot in that area, but also I, like a lot of teenagers, I didn't really know like what I wanted to do in the future. I didn't really feel like I necessarily had, you know, some sort of life purpose. But now I can really confidently say that I care so much about sharing my story and the work that I do because I know firsthand what it feels like to not have any hope, and being a messenger of hope in some sort of sense, like that means a lot to me. And I feel so privileged and grateful that I now have this platform, and also I have like the chance to go to Harvard and use education as like a lifeline, but that's not something that a lot of other young people in my shoes have. And that's why, like, that's what motivates me to do everything that I do and what really drives me, because, you know, I could very well be not in this position that I am today. And so utilizing it and doing as much good as I can really means a lot to me. So I think I feel a lot more like connected to just the work that I do and excited for my future, largely because of Cancer Kids First.
One last question. What does the future hold for you? I mean, what's next? And make it 45 seconds. I'll give you a minute. But you know, you have accomplished so much, and what are you, 20 now? Where do you go from here?
That is something that I am not fully certain yet, but ideally, I would love to pivot to startup and find some sort of way to integrate AI and technology into helping kids with cancer to close the survival gap in low and middle income countries. So, long-term career goal, that would be phenomenal. And at the same time, being able to continue writing books and speaking at different conferences and at schools to reach the younger generations to kind of, again, share my story and hopefully inspire them to change something in their life and make a difference in somebody else's life.
Well, we certainly applaud you. You know, continue the good work. It has been a real delight to talk with you. It is time out for this edition of 411 Teen. Many, many thanks to Olivia Zhang. Her book, Youth, The Young Person's Guide to Starting a Nonprofit. It's a blueprint for turning passion into action. Thank you so much, Olivia. You know, I really appreciate it. Much appreciation always to my listening audience for the time of, and your ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. The 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. If you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.